Okay, Erev Tov, we continue in the Rambam. We are going to start either today or tomorrow, chapter 69. And at this point in time, from 69 to the end, 76, the Rambam will be writing against a specific group of philosophical opponents. And the best way to look at this... No. That's a whole different story. So if you notice on the screen, and I'm sorry if it's not bigger, can you read it?
Yeah.
So this is from a book by Alfred L. Ivry, and I just was able to download it on Kindle today, and I was able to Kindle the text to my. To the Big Mac, so he has
Whoa.
Yes.
That was the kosher Big Mac.
It's a Big Mac.
That was when I was kindling the flame.
Anyway, so this he gives a little bit of an analysis and an introduction to these next seven chapters, and what he's going to do is he's going to take on a group of Muslims called the Calamists. Okay. And that's going to be the next seven chapters. Now, the reason he has to do that is a lot of what they say sounds a lot like Yiddishkeit. Oh. And therefore, it could be very subtly, you can go in the wrong direction. And what basically is happening up to now, there's always been issues with religion and philosophy at the time. And the Rambam's opinion always is, they're mamish, the proper philosophy, okay, Aristotle, with certain exceptions. But the primary philosophy, if you understand the philosophy properly and you understand Torah properly, there's very little difference between the two of them. Okay, now many people do not understand philosophy properly and Yiddishkeit philosophy, such as, with an example, like there's been the whole last 69 chapters. Like when it says, and God spoke, and God moved, and God this. So if you're the simple understanding, there's God has a physical body, you cannot resolve that with philosophy. And it's many Jews who thought God was a body. So then now you got a problem, because philosophers say, look, the world came in a certain way. And I said, God's got a body, so that can't go. So what do you got to do? You have to try to reconcile things. It means you got to either... push down or minimize what philosophy says, or you minimize what Yiddishkeit. You got to twist something into a pretzel, or are you going to reject philosophy? Out with it, philosophers, strafe, get out. Or you're going to have to make some changes into Yiddishkeit. So this sometimes reconciling things in a very uncomfortable way. So that's what many people did. The Rambam is saying you don't need to. You can really, they're pretty much, one explains, philosophy explains the Torah. However, in the next section, he'll say there are certain aspects of philosophy that are totally wrong. You know, for example, Torah Misinai. That's it. Like, they're totally wrong, the philosophers. They don't believe in that. So certain things that are completely wrong, you have to reject it. But there's a lot of intelligent things that philosophers said. Mm-hmm. And if you understand what the Torah says... it can fit in very nicely. Now, there are those, on the other hand, who felt you had to compromise on one of the two. And this is going to deal with one of these groups now, a Muslim group called the Calamists, who, if we will read a little bit, when we will get into the text, it will seem that they are pretty Jewish philosophy. But he says not, and it's the subtleties that are very important. So let's start, we're going to spend most of the class today, if not all, reading this analysis to bring the ideas home over here. And let's just read a little bit. In this section of the guide, by the analysis, okay, you might want to move the...
Left column.
Yeah, you might want to move it out to keep everybody's eyes focused. Yeah. In this section of the guide, Maimonides contrasts two visions of reality. One is an essentially Aristotelian natural philosophy. The other a theologically prescribed atomism. Now, what is atomism? It's pretty similar to what we have now, but they're saying, you know, like, for example, there's tiny pieces of, very, very tiny pieces of material with space in between them.
That's what okay? we have now.
And that was not now, but they take another step, and this is the dangerous step over here. You can apply the idea to atomism, to physical things that you see, but they also applied it to time.
Oh.
In other words, you have tiny little components of what we'll call time frames of reality. So in other words, just like you're saying with a piece of paper, there's millions of little pieces of atomic paper pieces here with little space in between, but we're talking so small, okay? As opposed to saying, no, this is a whole thing, right? So they say the same thing with time, that although you're looking at time, it looks like one piece, but no, it's little itty-bitty pieces of time with a little space in between, and every time frame is a new time frame of reality separate from before. Okay? This is all part of this atomism. Now, it's going to be all kinds of issues about existence when that is, because then, what we'll see, he's going to explain it, there is really no relationship between the present and what happened just before and what's going to happen later.
Each has their own separate time segment.
That's right.
They're not connected.
Now, in the good old days, when you had cartoons, how they used to do it, right? They'd make a million
frames,
and each one was just a little different than the next, right? So what these columnists are going to say, they're going to be very big into this idea, okay? And therefore, just because something happened this minute doesn't mean that something altogether different, like totally different, can happen the next second. So this is where it gets dangerously subtle. Let me just read a little bit before you ask questions, because I know what has to come down the pipe, and I know I haven't explained enough yet. But we'll have lots of times for questions. Okay, now, back into the next. Maimonides sides with the philosophical view and offers a brief description of the basic tenets of his physics and metaphysics. He reserves his doubts about the validity of Aristotelian metaphysics for later, section 2. In other words, although he overwhelmingly agrees with a lot of Aristotelian philosophy, some areas he totally does not agree with, and that'll be later on. Being concerned to settle his quarrel with the theological position first, dealing with the Calamists. That's what he's going to do now in the next 7 chapters. Okay, now who are these people? The theologians of Islam were proficient in ilm al kalam. I'm probably mispronouncing this at all completely. The science of kalam. What is kalam? Easy. Kalam is a term that literally means speech or language. Okay, the paradigm of which was the speech of God in the Quran. Okay, so these kalam, the kalam is the, I guess, the buzzword, you know, and the people who espouse that are the mitukalimon. Okay, those are the people who espouse this philosophy. Now, the next paragraph is going to sound just like Yiddishkeit. Okay? The mutukalimon were those men who wished to rationalize that speech, verbalize a worldview that would support their desire to understand God and his relation to the world in logical terms. Okay? Their point of departure based on the Quran was that he is the, here's a critical point, the creator of the world, an omnipotent, omniscient, and just being whose nature is behind, beyond human comprehension. So right now, what do you think? Sounds good.
So far.
Okay, now obviously this is going to be different than the philosophers who don't agree with that. But now, still on there. Okay. Next paragraph, the Betul Kalimon believed that God, in his compassion for humanity, gives us the illusion of perceiving a natural body that has permanent or at least enduring properties, Mostly they saw him in recreating the world each instant through momentary combinations of atoms and accidents, and nothing has substantive weight on its own. So again, it sounds like what you daven every morning, that Hashem is mechadesh b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh bereishis. Hashem renews creation at all times.
The accident sounds problematic.
So saying nothing has substantive weight of its own. Mm. In other words, you have what happened this minute, and then that's it. It vanishes. Mm-hmm. And now you got something brand new
next
next second. Okay. But without any connection to what was before. Okay. Still, it still sounds pretty kosher.
Hashem has to will every second.
Yeah. Yes. But, now, in this manner, the metukalimun, again, now, in some of the Hebrew texts, they'll call them the medabrim, the speakers, because they believed that the speech of God, very important, gave voice to a deep sensibility in Islam that echoed the Quran's insistence on God's unilateral sovereignty in the world, not to be challenged by any natural law or normative physical intermediaries. Ah, this is where it takes great going away from the regular philosophers. In other words, they do not believe there is any creation in any natural way, okay? There was nothing else but God runs the show. No intermediaries, no nothing. Now this, now the scientists are going to say everything was a natural progression. The philosophers may say there's a first cause. They're not going to call it God. Okay? Yeah. And there's a natural progression that comes from whatever nature
evolution
did. But there's, and things like pick up where other things leave off. They're saying, no, everything is God. Everything has gotten. You're going to say, well, wait a minute. That sounds pretty much the same as Yiddishkeit.
Yeah.
But not really, because Hashem, what you're really going to see is Hashem creates nature and lets nature work through Hashem guiding nature. They didn't say that. They just say it's God. There's like no nature at all, so to speak. That's one difference. The Metukalim saw the scientific tradition to which the philosophers subscribe, even though it came to accommodate traditional religious beliefs in many instances, as positing an autonomous or semi-autonomous natural world. So the philosophers felt the world takes care of itself, right? The Metukalim said, no, the world does not take care of itself. And the fact is, every second God does something and there's nothing natural at all.
And it's not connected to the previous second.
And it's not connected to the previous as well. In their animus against philosophy, the Metukalim developed arguments voiced earlier by John Philoponus and other Christian thinkers against Aristotle's scientific treatises, becoming sophisticated advocates of their position, and they were against Aristotle completely.
Wow.
They said that there's nothing about, we don't agree with anything that they say.
So this is just before Rambam or during
Yeah,
Rambam?
A lot of these were before Rambam and some were during Rambam.
Okay, got it. So like in the year 1000.
Yeah, probably whatever. Or could be even earlier, but there was a, no, well, the philosophers.
Only 640
yeah,
Muhammad,
right,
so
right, right.
750 and 100.
Good. Now, the philosophers, on the other hand, viewed the Metukalim as dogmatic and pseudo-rational thinkers, threatening the legitimacy of scientific inquiry in Islam. So that's, this comes along every, certain amount of generations. You have it similar to the, now, let's say you have evolution and the creationists.
Yeah.
And the two of them cannot agree on anything,
right?
So this always keeps coming up just in a different flavor. Now he lists a few of the big Metukalim, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Farabi, Avicenna, they were people who came before the Rambam, and Averroes, who was at the same time of the Rambam, all opposed the Mekulamenum. Okay, even though these were, Muslims, but they did not agree with that. Okay, Averroes trying valiantly to rebut Al-Ghazali's, another Muslim, incoherence of philosophers in the incoherence of incoherence. Okay, meaning to say that they could not reconcile to the philosophers. Okay? Other ones were trying to reconcile, that the Tukalim do not reconcile. Okay? And that really, eventually, it prevails in the Islamic world, not to reconcile to the philosophers. Right. That's how they did it. And therefore, the Rambam, who's now, I don't know, say caught in the middle, I don't know what the right term to use is, you got the philosophers here, and so to say, these Mitukalim are over here. There were some who wanted to, some Islamists reconcile. Wanted to reconcile it, right. Didn't win, and they just said, we're not reconciling. That seemed to be the way it went in that era of the Rambam. Mm-hmm. And to that, the Rambam is not, he's going to say, I got to shoot these guys down. So he's going to shoot down these Mutal Alkim, and then till the end of this section of the book. And the next section, as much as I may agree with the philosophers, I got to say there's certain things with the philosophers that are totally not right, and we cannot accept what they are saying. Okay. Now, Maimonides is thus following a venerable philosophical tradition in challenging the views and methodology of the Mutal Kilimon. Nor is he favorably disposed to earlier Jewish writers like Rav Sadia Gaon, who compromised their attempts at philosophizing with Kalam-style arguments.
Where's the next page?
Okay. In other words, Rav Sadia... What?
Where does he go to the next page?
Oh.
You just have to shift it. Okay, anyway, so it seems that Rambam is even going to argue on Rav Sadia Gaon. Okay, Rav Sadia Gaon was a bit like these Mutakalims, but he's not going to refer to Rav Sadia, he's just going to refer to these Mutakali people. Okay, but that's another story. Okay, again, the Rambam keeps saying, if you guys are against philosophy, it's not like, you know, Rav Sadia Gaon is, like, dumb. Certainly not dumb. But, in other words, didn't totally understand what the philosophers were saying. Okay, and is there a fly bombing you?
Oh, yeah. That's okay.
Okay, anyways, Yetzirah. It's a lesson that the Yetzirah never gives up. So anyway, or you have to understand philosophy better. And that's where they part ways. Okay, in the guide, however, Maimonides ignores his Jewish predecessors and attacks the Muslim adherents of Kalam, though without mentioning any by name. His description of their tenets and arguments is a pastiche drawn from various sources, an attempt to get at what he believes is the heart of their arguments, describe the major schools of Kalam thought, and persuade the reader of the sophistic nature of their reasoning. Not sophistical, but sophistic. Maimonides is engaged in a polemic against Kalam teachings, and like all polemicists, he may be simplifying and distorting the complex and qualified positions of his adversaries. In other words, he's dumbing it down, so to speak, But he's disproving it. The picture of Kalam that emerges is thus not representative of the rich diversity of views held by the Mitkalim, but rather reflects Maimonides' own projection of their key premises, arranged systematically, as is his practice. Okay, again, and the Rambam is always against those who are trying to reconcile things and distort things, and he says, you don't have to do this. So in other words, you know, I guess this writer who knew, like, really in deep what this Kalam is held, Rambam's not going to go through a full 9 yards of the Kalam. He's going to give you the basic kernel and shoot it down, because that's the idea. The reader of the guide is ostensibly a Jewish intellectual who was attracted to the methodology and entire theological orientation of the Mitukalimun. In other words, you've got a history of philosophy going on over here. You have Aristotle and all those philosophers. Now the Jews are living in Arab lands, Muslim lands. You got the Muslims giving philosophy over here. And since the Mitukalim were pretty close to Yiddishkeit, and, you know, not as close as the philosophers, so Jews could say, I guess that makes a lot of sense. And that's why the Rambam, after explaining everything about the incorporeal reality of Hashem and explaining how Yiddishkeit in so many ways is not different than philosophy, because we understand that Hashem is not a corporeal being. So now he has to deal with these mutukalim. My mind's aware that kalam could be attractive to a bright and devout person, and that its core arguments for an omnipotent creator could be adopted by Jews and Christians as well as by Muslims. Karaite Jewish authors had already shown an affinity for kalam arguments, and Maimonides may have feared its appeal to rabbinic scholars too. Remember what we said in the beginning sounds a lot. Omnipotent God, everything changes every moment. That is very much normative Jewish philosophy at first blush. The rabbinic tradition lacked a systematic theology that incorporated a scientific worldview, leaving a void that Maimonides tried to fill in outline form in his rabbinic writings. Now, in the guide, he is explicit in attempting to construct a theology based on classical philosophical sources. He felt it is his duty to refute kalam arguments and the principles on which they were based, convinced that the path of God's presence lay solely through study of science and philosophy. Maimonides feels most challenged by what he calls now he's going to get into, he's going to talk about 11 or 12 principles of kalam. He's going to go through in this sefer, and he's going to attack them. But the biggest one is the 10th premise of the mutam, calling it the main proposition of the science of kalam. It is the affirmation that whatever, here's the point where you're going to start the arguments over here. It is the affirmation that whatever may be imagined may possibly occur. Wow. That was the kalam philosophy. If I can imagine, okay, I can imagine that that building is going to fall apart. So there's no reason why it can't fall apart in the next second. Not 50 years from now because it wore out. Can you imagine that building falling down? Can you imagine it?
No.
You can't?
Not right now.
I designated it.
We saw Surfside. Yeah. If my mind can imagine it, then it could be. Like that's it. And now it could be destroyed tomorrow.
Use the bridge example even.
Okay. No, we're going now. He says, short of logically absurd, because self-contradictory, to tell me the bull is going to fly. Okay, that's already absurd. But for to say this thing will just destroy itself, you know, that could be. Future events are not limited to the range of previous experience and the categorization of it in a generic universal terms. The intellect must accept as admissible almost whatever possibilities the imagination places before. Remember, Rambam was very much against this imagination. Yeah. He says, now he's not, he's saying, listen, if the thing's up there, it has to fit certain scientific rules. Oh, okay. And that's a pretty sturdy thing. It ain't falling tomorrow. Now, yeah, of course, if you shoot a bomb at it, it could be destroyed. But for you to just tell me it's just going to collapse for no reason, well, I could imagine it. Yeah. Okay, you can imagine it, but that it doesn't mean that's going to happen.
Imagine it mean visualize it?
Yeah.
What do you think
it happened? In other words, if I can imagine it, then why can't it happen? Because here's the point. The thing is, it's only existing, according to them, because God willed it into existence for that second. Now the next second, God could change his mind.
I'm bringing back.
Okay, and whatever atoms are there could be rearranged.
Yeah.
And then could fall down. Now to say it's going to fly, right, that's already a little bit wild. But to say the whole thing can decompose instantly, right, is something that could happen, right? Because remember, the Mutakalim, they're saying there's nothing about science over here. It's all God. Now, we understand, God has used science. He is science.
He's made the rules.
He is the rules. He is science. And therefore, Hashem has it work in a scientific way, right, which that itself is miraculous. And then there could be something called a nes. But we don't usually count on that happening very often. And even if we could think about it, it's not necessarily going to be. Okay?
But did the Calvinists say that God can change his mind second to second? Because in Judaism, we don't believe that God
can change his mind. Right, that's what he's saying. That could be.
Because we don't believe that. God doesn't change his mind. It's not like he's like us. Oh, you know what? It's not good now. But it was good before. That can't happen.
Right, you'll see it's much deeper than this. Maimonides presents the view of Mutukalim on this issue as best he can, but pauses to issue a call to the reader's attention, a summons or reminder of what for him are the epistemological facts of life. Remember, how did we define epistemology? It's the theory of knowledge, okay, concerned with the mind's relation to reality. Okay, so you're investigating, it's investigating what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. In other words, how does knowledge work? How do we think about this? So these are the epistemological facts of life. He offers was in effect a paean, meaning a praise to the human intellect. He says human intellect, it's the intellect that the Rambam says is important, not the imagination. If your intellect says that there's science making this happen, then that's what's happening, right? Now, if you're imagining something, which also comes from your brain, but that's not intellect, and you got to separate, and that's where they're going to part ways. The realm of the pure intellectual, so we got to understand things that make sense intellectually, and that's what science is intellectually. Where then Mutalkim says, no, if I can just imagine it, it doesn't have to be intellect. It is the faculty that distinguishes man from other animals and relates him to God, the Rambam. It takes the individual impressions of object that the imaginative faculty presents it with and abstracts from them to determine the essence and attributes predicated of its subject and to understand the matrix of causes with which the object is involved and which help define it. It is the intellect and not the imagination that constructs the universal terms by which we define objects and delimit their possibilities. All right, that's where the clear distinction is happening. And you're going to say, why? Okay, we'll probably talk about that tomorrow, why it has to be that way. Maimonides brings demonstrated proofs from the mathematical sciences as evidence of the superiority of the intellectual faculty to that of the imagination in assessing what is admissible to imagine as truly possible. Of course, the postulates of mathematics assume the existence of the world as we know it, an assumption the Mutukalkim reject. Maimonides knows this and delineates the difference in the philosopher and the Mutukalkim in just this manner. The falasuf accepts that which exists as the basis for distinguishing between the necessary, the possible, and the impossible. The Mutukalkim rejects the objective facticity of that which exists. Rambam says this exists. There's a whole science behind how it existed, and we got to continue from that. Well, Matukum says, who said it's existing there? It could be all different tomorrow, the next minute. Seeing it as a product of divine will with no necessary entailments, just God's will, finished. You don't need anything else. Well, we're going to say God's will created the science that makes it happen. It merges together. The proofs that mathematics and other sciences bring do not compel the Mutukalkim to deny their non-necessary and hence non-certain nature, as they are all contingent upon the will of God and could be imagined differently in different existences. Rambam says you have certain philosophical facts. God made those philosophical facts, and they're not going to change.
No.
Gravity is not going to change. No. You know, certain theories of speed and this, all these physics rules. It's all with God. And they're saying, what are you talking about? It's whatever God does, whenever he does. What are you talking about?
Kind of a point. Like, God could just make an earthquake and then the building comes down.
But he didn't. He chose not
so
to.
So he chose to have an earthquake. Later, well, it
comes down. But that's pre-programmed into the program.
No, God could just say, I want to have an earthquake
now. He can't just say it. It has to be pre-programmed there. Like the splitting of the scene. It wasn't God.
Hashem.
Are you saying every earthquake has been pre-programmed?
Yes.
From the beginning of time.
Has to be. Or there's something that changed that God didn't know about.
Yeah.
Remember, that's the problem. God.
Can't be, shall we?
Wait a second. Then when we say, Robbie, you said this, that that the world is so corrupt and there's no That's God. Right. Now we get tornadoes and we get hurricanes.
And, you know, God knew this. Remember, Shelley, there can't be anything that God doesn't know.
Yeah. No. So he made it happen.
No.
He made it happen.
But when God created the world, here's the question. When God created the world, 6,000 years, whatever, did he know that the corrupt people today?
Yes.
Okay. He knew that then. And there he already brought put the earthquake into the, what do you call it?
Into the program.
Into the program. At that time. There's nothing new. Ain't called.
Don't we say there's only, like, I can't remember the number, 5-7 things that God did, like Bilam speaking.
Were you here?
He missed
Wednesday's class.
So he said the splitting of the sea, he said was pre-programmed
on day two.
When he created the sea.
Only those 10 things were Beina Shmushim pre-programmed, but everything else was pre-programmed
on the day it was created. So he created the plates of the earth, he pre-programmed the earthquakes, all of
that would be on the first day.
Yeah.
Well, no, earth was second day.
Yeah.
Okay, second day.
Earth is third day.
So water is second day.
He programmed that before man existed.
Yes.
If man does wrong, and that's why earthquakes have to come.
But he should program
the earthquakes before he created man.
He's outside of time.
And when he created man, he knows what man is. He knows what man is going to do as well. Okay. Now you're gonna. And the reason is because Hashem can't change.
He can't. You know what? This is really upsetting me. I'm going to do an earthquake now.
Right. So that doesn't happen. That's where the Metoalkim and the Rambam disagrees.
No,
it's Shelley. We say it, but from our perspective, not from Hashem's perspective. That's where the big difference is. From our perspective, we don't know what Hashem has pre-programmed. Okay?
That's the free will.
And we don't know that Hashem knows what our free will choices are. And that, we said, is the famous question. So where's our free will if God knows? But that's beyond for us to understand. But there's no such thing as, God didn't know what's going to happen. God never calls audibles at the line.
Rabbi, that was very good.
Only we.
He doesn't call it audibles.
We call audibles.
Who's 60 shirts?
We call audibles, but we think they're audibles. Yeah. From our perspective, it's audible, but not from Hashem's perspective. Okay, so now we'll just finish up. Maimonides is us aware of the fundamental and unbridgeable difference between the basic existential premises of philosophers and the Metoalkim. He believes the latter do not accept the necessary validity of sense perceptions any more than the proofs that the intellect offers, that a mystic physics is a self-contained alternative reality. That's it.
Whoa.
Just atoms and nothing else, and no system, so to speak.
Wow.
Okay? Maimonides' quarrel with Kalam is testimony, therefore, to his firm belief in the enduring existence of that world which presents itself to our senses and serves legitimately as the arbiter of that which may be possible based on that which is and has been actual. This is the world that the Aristotelian philosophical tradition has largely described, recognizing the intellect's role in discerning essential and accidental properties of a thing and establishing categories of thought and speech that identify an individual object, in relation to other objects with which it shares common properties. Wow. For Maimonides, then, the imagining is or ought to be controlled by the intellect. The imagination cannot function properly without depending on the concepts that the intellect provides as a result of past experience. That a mystic theory of the Metoalkim recognizes no necessary connection between past and present moments. And for Maimonides, would be exploiting a discredited past in using terms that have no essential definitions. Each existential moment of the Metoalkim is its own reality created by God from nothing. The Kalam world, for many of its adherents, is thus a world of continuous creation ex nihilo, supported by an elaborate atomistic philosophical theory. Maimonides will proceed to punch holes in the Kalam's proofs for creation, but as we shall see, he is not immune to the lure of positing creation from nothing on grounds not entirely like those posited by the Metoalkim. So there's going to be some areas that he's similar to them, most areas similar to the philosophers, and less areas where he's totally disagreeing with the philosophers. And now, this is all general. Now, tomorrow, we're going to get into the real details. In other words, can we call God a creator, or do we call him the first cause? And you're going to say, what's the difference?
Oh.
And there's major differences. Yeah, yeah, and that's what we're going to get to tomorrow.
Okay. Wow.